Okay, Minor Prophets, here we go. Everyone ready? Let's pray and go. It's going to be fun today since we have this class twice, but we're just in summaries, so it's like... Okay. You should not be here on Friday with me, because I have other classes to take care of. I mean, I'll see you for theology on Friday. But that should be it. So my plan for this morning, particularly in this period, is we're just going to go through the things that are in the setup, in the schedule. So we will go through Jonah and Nahum. We'll be done when we're done. So we might finish a little early. We'll just see. And then fourth hour, we'll go through Habakkuk and Zephaniah, which means Wednesday we'll hit Haggai and Zechariah and have exam four on Monday. I know Monday exams are rough, but it'll be better that way. And I think the summaries exam is, in some ways it's the easiest. In some ways it may be a little harder because there's a lot of different prophets, but like we don't go over the same kind of depth in them. So hopefully everything will be okay. As you know, I grade with loving mercy and strict holiness. So we will deal with those things on Monday. But that'll put the exam on Monday. And that'll give me time to review the exam and find out like all the things. Because if you have a 94 at that point, you are exempt from the final. But the final will be online. And... once you know you can take it. So I'm going to try to get all the finals from my class to set up this week, so it won't be any issue. But that should cover it. But we will be done Monday with class. I mean, Wednesday you can show up for fourth hour, but I know a lot of people leave early or whatever. We'll have review and just discussion time and get things set. But that should complete stuff. Yes. Probably, yes. We'll talk about theology in theology class, just so I can keep stuff straight. But, yeah, I think that's how I had it planned, so the theology and the minor prophets exams aren't on the same day. Okay, we are in Jonah. Jonah. So let's talk some background for Jonah. Through his prophetic book, readers receive a personal picture of the personality of Jonah. We get to know Jonah in a very different level than we do the other prophets because Jonah is written in a different manner than the other prophets. So you get a much more interesting, personal, sometimes crazy look at this guy. Outside of the book, Jonah is mentioned in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 25, during the reign of Jeroboam II. Jonah had predicted the recovery of some land for Israel, and which took place, of course, because he was speaking for God. And Jonah is from Israel, from the town of Gath-hepher. So Jonah is a northern prophet. With setting, Jonah was a contemporary of Amos and Hosea. He was at the same time as them, and he also prophesied in Israel in the middle of the 8th century, so around 750. Israel seemed to be doing well nationally at this time. Assyria, while a powerful nation in the northeast, and certainly present, globally speaking, was not actually a threat during the time of Jonah's ministry. Regardless, they had a fearsome reputation, and they would ultimately be the nation that would conquer Israel. Some of the other prophets, Amos, Hosea, kind of indicating that thing, but Jonah is a bit earlier in the scheme, like compared to Amos. So, by the time Amos is there, and Amos is prophesying, Assyria has sort of recovered from these events and is a threat at that point. But during the time of Jonah, Assyria is still kind of distant. It's not really a threat to Israel in a significant way. It's out there, everyone's aware of them, but they're not interacting a lot with Israel at this point in time. Which is good for us to know, especially if you've been influenced heavily by VeggieTales. Because in there, Assyria is much more like, you know, they're evil and they're a threat against us kind of thing. And it's true, but just not really a significant threat. In terms of theme, the book conveys the sovereign authority of God repeatedly over and over. We see that take place in the book. He controls the weather, he controls animals, he controls plants, and ultimately, though he does this without coercion in the book, he controls people. So he doesn't have to coerce, he doesn't have to force people, but he does control them. In counterpoint to this, the book of Jonah also gives a rich display of the grace of God, who grants life and forgiveness to a rebellious prophet, and to a foreign nation. So we kind of get both sides of these issues in Jonah. How many of you feel reasonably comfortable with the story of Jonah? Anyone not? Like, you're like, I'm not really sure much about Jonah. Okay, good. So we're going to go through this pretty quick. Since you guys have at least some familiarity with the book, you should have read it, of course, and you know, it's all over. Jonah's one of the ones, like, I've seen secular things make reference to Jonah, just because the story is kind of captivating, in some ways. Mostly because Jonah becomes captive. I hadn't put that together, but there it is. Okay, so word of the Lord comes to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." So, "Jonah, I have a job for you. I want you to go to Nineveh. You're going to preach against this." But Jonah rose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. You see Tarshish emphasized here a number of times in these verses. Tarshish has been historically identified on the Mediterranean coast of Spain. Whether or not that's the actual Tarshish Jonah is aiming for, we could talk about and debate, but that tends to be the identification. The point is that rather than obey God, Jonah goes in the opposite direction and is trying to go as far as he can get. God says, "I want you to go this way to Assyria." And Jonah says, "Yes, sir." And he goes that way, and he goes as far as he can get. That's his plan. "I will go to Tarshish. I will go to the edge of the world to try to get away from this obligation." So, of course, he does that. Gets in the boat. God hurls a great wind upon the sea. Storm comes up. Everyone's worried, all the sailors, the captain. Finally, they start getting everyone together, and he goes down and he finds Jonah asleep. Some people say in commentary stuff like Jonah felt so secure in his running away from God that he could sleep in there. I don't think that's the case. I think he was exhausted. I don't know if you guys, I mean, you're fairly young, so this may not be something that has impacted you yet, but if you ever try running from God, you ever work at disobeying what you know is the clear compulsion of God to do something, it's not something you feel secure with. It's something that exhausts you. And I think that's more what happened. He was just totally plumb exhausted. So he's in the ship, he falls asleep, and how exhausted was he? I mean, even if you're really tired and you feel secure and you're just enjoying sleep, a storm is still going to wake you up. But if you're exhausted, you can go through a lot of stuff and not wake up. And that's what happens. So the captain gets him, finds him, he's sleeping. So captain's, you know, whatever, get up. We got to figure out what's going on. So they get everyone together. They say, let us cast lots. We got to find out what's going on. Because they are convinced, the sailors are convinced, what is taking place is not a natural storm. I mean, they've been on the Mediterranean Sea. They're sailors. And they have an idea of what's normal and what's common. And they are recognizing this is an unusual thing. This is not natural. There is some power that is trying to accomplish something, and we need to figure out what it is. And so they get together and say, let's cast lots so we can know why this is happening. So they cast the lots, and the lot falls to Jonah. And they said to him, okay, by lot, which is not a great way of determining something, but it's what, you know, they thought was going to work. But God is in control of it, controls it to make it fall to Jonah. They said, so tell us, why has this evil come upon us? What is your occupation? What is it you do? And where do you come from? What country? What people? You know, we want all the information we can get now. And so he says to them, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord God, the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land. And the men were exceedingly afraid. Okay, so your God is a God who's in control of all of this stuff, and that's who you are? You say, what have you done? So he didn't just tell them, I'm a Hebrew and I worship the true and living God who made all this stuff. But he also told them in the process, I'm running away from him. That doesn't get recorded, but clearly in the response of the sailors, that's what they understood. Because then they're like, what have you done? They're exceedingly afraid. Not just a little afraid. They're terrified. What is it you have done? For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. So it gets stated, but we just don't have it recorded. Then, because they're terrified of what's going on, they're in the middle of this storm. You keep that in mind when you're reading through this. This isn't, as you go through Jonah, like sometimes we break it apart and, oh, this big storm comes upon. And then they have time to have this whole conversation. Sometimes this happens in our television, and so it becomes part of the way we think about things when we're, you know, just imagining what's going on, right? Have you ever watched a television show and you're like, wait a minute, who in the middle of this is breaking up, all this stuff is going on, and they have time to break apart from that and have a whole conversation? Let me give you an example of this. In a movie, I'm not suggesting you see, I'm not advocating the movie, but I happen to have seen the movie, and so I can use it as an example, but I just forgot the name of it. The third Batman. The Batman Rises, or... Yeah, Dark Knight Rises. Okay, sure. How many of you have seen this movie? Okay, good. Some of you, oh, a lot of you are going to know exactly what I'm talking about. At the end of the movie, there's like a nuclear bomb, right? A nuclear bomb is going to blow up Gotham because we have to keep amping up, you know, after three movies. We've blown a bunch of stuff up. Now we have to blow it up in a radioactive, huge way. So, nuclear bomb, and it's ticking off. Ding, ding. Ding. They're like, oh no, we're all going to die. And Batman's like, it's okay, I'll save you. So he's like, ties it up to the you know, his helicoptery bat thing, whatever. And he's like, it's all right. But then, the girl in the movie is like, oh, Batman, I love you. And he's like, I love you too. And let's take, while the nuclear warhead is counting down right next to us, let's take 15, 20 seconds to really smooch it out right now. You know, what in the world? I was watching the movie with a friend who's really into like comic books and comic book movies and things like that. And so I enjoy watching those things when I'm with him because he's into it. I mean, he loves it. And he's the kind of person too, even in theater, when it's funny, he laughs out loud. I'm not much of like a really loud laugher. Like I'll smile, and that's like my laugh. I'm like, huh? But he'll do it. So I'm having this good time with him, and I'm watching this, and I was like, wait a minute. Like I was with this movie all the way up to this point, right? Sure, I'll buy it. Whatever. He's in a prison in the Middle East. Whatever. He climbs out of the thing. Go Batman. But then you have a nuclear bomb counting down, and you're like, let's take an extra 30 seconds. Let's take a minute. I mean, who cares? Right? So I won't get a minute further away. Maybe 10,000 people die from radiation exposure. But man, this kiss is going to be worth it. No. I've never been in this situation, but I know that if I were in this situation, I would be doing everything I could to get that thing as far away as I could and not taking the extra time. I mean, I would be like in my helicopter flying away looking at my wife and being like, because that's all we had time for, right? It was a little blow the kiss while I'm flying, not their thing. It just, yeah, clearly gets me hot. And so that's what they're, with Jonah, they're like, what is going on? But this conversation is all taking place while a storm is raging about them. It's not like everything paused so they could have this conversation. Storm is going and they're talking to Jonah, and Jonah says, I worship the living God, but I'm running away from him. And they're like, you're an idiot! We are going to die because of everything that you are doing. What do we do? He's your God. You are a prophet. You speak for the God that is doing all this. What is it we do? And so Jonah tells them. Because they say, what should we do so that the sea will quiet for us? Because it was growing more and more tempestuous. So it's not just that it's raging, it's getting worse. And he said to them, this is what to do. Pick me up and hurl me into the sea, then the sea will quiet down for you. And for I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you. Here's some things I would like to say about this in verse 12. This may be a continuation of Jonah's attempts for avoidance. Most commentaries I read, that's what they say. In fact, I'm going to give you an alternate understanding of these verses, but I am the only one that I have read, and if I've even read my own stuff, but I'm the only one I know of that has had this view. So you are not required to hold this view. It just happens to be correct. Most things that I read make this a continued effort of Jonah to avoid God. He's trying to avoid God. And he gets in the boat, storm chases after him, he's still trying to avoid God. So the people say, what do we do? And he says, throw me over. Because he's thinking, is what they say, he's thinking, if I can at least get in the water, you know, then I'm still further away from God. I'm not going to submit to God. And so that's the main idea that gets communicated. I don't think that's what happened. I think here, this is rightly taken as a prophecy of Jonah. Typically, you will read that Jonah has only one line of prophecy in it. It's what he says later to Nineveh when he gets there. But I think there are two. And I think this is a prophecy. The guys say, what do we do to appease God, to quiet the storm? And Jonah tells them exactly what to do. Pick me up and throw me into the water. Now the guys, the other sailors, already think Jonah's an idiot because he's running away from God. And so they say, what do we do? And he says, throw me into the water. They're like, man, you have lost your mind. And so they row even harder. That's what it says. That's their response. They rowed hard to get back to land, but they could not because it was getting worse and worse and worse. So they don't want to throw Jonah into the water. They're not going to kill a guy. And because if they are afraid that here's God, now the Lord, and he's chasing us down with a storm because of this guy. If we kill this guy, what's he going to do to us then? I mean, they're being serious with the situation, and they view Jonah as kind of off of his rocker. So they work hard to get back, but it doesn't work. The storm just gets worse and worse and worse. They can't do anything. So verse 14, they call out to the Lord, O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life. So we're going to do it, but, you know, it's against our better judgment, and we don't want to die because we're going to violate your law. We're going to kill a man. So they're taking it seriously, but they don't know what else to do. So they listen to Jonah, they pick him up and heave him over the side. They hurl him into the sea, and the sea ceased its raging, which is part of why I think this is a prophecy. Because what Jonah said would happen is exactly what happens. You pick me up and throw me into the sea, and it'll calm down. And so they don't want to do it, but finally they submit, they pick him up, toss him overboard, and then everything just whoosh, is still. And the sense of it is that this is a quick and immediate reaction. And so I think what Jonah did here was actually prophesy, this is what to do. So you can take that for what it's worth, think it over, let it marinate in the brain for a while. You may come to the same conclusion I have come to. Yes? What's that? Yes, absolutely. God does that sometimes. It's a very political response, Logan. It's good politician. Yes and no at the same time. I do it often, and it's fine. So that's what happens. Now, I don't know if you've ever had to throw anyone overboard and have the storm quit when you did it. But I imagine they throw Jonah overboard. Whew, everything is calm. And that's the sense of it right here. Now, what would your response be? Mine would be, okay, let's fish that guy back out of the water. Right? In case we need him again. What if the storm comes back up? Apparently throwing him into the water calms everything down. So let's get that guy back. And but they don't want to kill the guy, right? That was their thing. So everything calms down. Everything stops. Of course, if everything stops, even sails, if they have sails, however they're moving, their sails are probably furled right now because you wouldn't want sails up in the middle of a storm. That's why they were rowing. So everything stops. And they're like, okay, let's back up. Let's go pick that guy up, right? If you've ever heaved a guy anywhere, you typically don't make a lot of distance, right? Unless Jonah's like this tiny little guy. He's not that far off. He's just over here. So let's hold up. Let's get him out of the water. And so they go through the process of trying to fish him out. That would be my understanding of the situation. As they're coming back to do that, a great fish swallows up Jonah. They're like, okay, let's get that guy out. And then a fish just goes, oh! They're like, nope. So what do the sailors do? The sailors go, they finally get back to land. They make sacrifices and vows to God. They become worshipers of the Lord. Another reason I think it was prophecy. Because the guys see what happened, happens as Jonah predicted it would happen, and they respond in worship, in faithfulness to God. So the rest of the story then focuses on the events that go on. So we leave the introduction behind and we look at the praying prophet who's now inside the fish. Man, sometimes you read stuff about, is it a fish or a whale? And people get angry. Right? It says a great fish, not a whale. A whale is a mammal. Man. You know what? The Bible can call a whale a fish because that's kind of what a whale is, right? The Bible is not concerned about a technical decision that whales are mammals because of how they give birth or anything like that. The Bible is just trying to describe what happened. So a great fish may very well be a whale. Is it necessarily a whale? No, we don't know. It's just a big fish. That's all I know. It could be a big koi, for all I know. The thing could have just, like a goldfish. It didn't come up and like do this. It just came up and was like, and just sucked Jonah right in. And Jonah's just like, and then he went to the fish. I don't know. So he's inside the fish, but what does he do in the fish? Jonah prays to God. And he gives this prayer in chapter 2 is actually a prayer of thanksgiving. It's a psalm. And it's a psalm in light of his drowning. See, Jonah didn't want to die. He's stuck in the water. He saw the boat kind of stop and everything. He sees the storm die out just like he said it would. He sees the guys get the rope and he's like, all right. And that's when the fish came up and got him. But he's afraid he's going to drown. And so when he realizes that's not what's going to happen, he gives this prayer out to God, chapter 2. And he prays through the thing. The flow of the psalm actually mirrors events in chapter 1. The way that the psalm is structured. We have crisis. We have prayer. We have deliverance. And we have sacrifices. As you work your way through the psalm. The prayer itself represents a significant change in Jonah's approach to the Lord. And it's also similar to some other psalms in the book of Psalms, which indicates that Jonah was aware of those and that they are connected in some way. So he gives this prayer of thanksgiving, Lord, you are good and you're God. And so he comes out at the end of the chapter, the Lord spoke to the fish and it vomited Jonah out upon dry land. Horrifying, but this is what has happened. So chapter 3, we get the preaching prophet. Jonah now goes to Nineveh. The size of the city is literally in the text a distance of 3 days. That's how it's measured. Like a light year, right? A light year is a distance, but it's a distance equivalent to, you know, how far light can travel in a year. And so that's kind of when he measures the city. He doesn't give us like miles or kilometers or stadia or anything like that. He says it was a distance of 3 days. That's likely describing the amount of time it would require for Jonah to pass through the major lanes of the city in order to declare his message. And it is generally assumed that the Nineveh at this point is not just the city proper, but it's kind of like any major city in the United States. You go to, like, you go to Denver or something like that. You go to Denver, you actually drive through any number of cities as you're passing through Denver. There's, you know, Aurora or Vada, you know, wherever. It depends how you drive through the thing. But you actually go through a number of cities, but we just call it, collectively, we call it Denver, because that's the principal thing. Nineveh was kind of like that. It had more of a district going on to it, and it, for him to traverse it, to go through the city in a sufficient way to deliver this message would take 3 days. It doesn't mean it would take him 3 days to walk across the city from end to end, but to travel the lanes in order to deliver the message. Verse 9 of chapter 3. Well, we get the response of everyone. And so, picking up in verse 8, kind of in the middle, this is the king of Nineveh. He says, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence in his hands. Who knows? God may turn and relent and turn from his fierce anger so that we may not perish. So he takes it seriously. This change likely does not reflect a deep spiritual change in the lives of the Assyrians. Rather, it reflects their response and willingness to believe that their evil has come under judgment. This doesn't mean that, like, Assyria or Nineveh for a period of time became worshipers of the true and living God. It just means, as this oddity comes into the city and begins proclaiming it, they are willing to go, no, we are sinners, and to respond to that. But in a short period of time after Jonah, this is all going to wear off and they're going to go attacking people and being evil anyway. So it's not a deep spiritual change. Chapter 4, we get the pouting prophet. Verses 1 through 3, it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. And he prayed to the Lord, and he said, O Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my own country? Before all of this started, this is exactly what I said would happen. You would be nice. This is why I went to Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious and merciful God, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and relenting from disaster. And I didn't want that to happen to these people. Therefore now, O Lord, please take my life from me, for it is better for me to die than to live. And the Lord said, do you do well to be angry? Oh, Jonah's angry, right? Just kill me. That's how upset he is. Jonah is upset that God is gracious because his enemies are saved from their destruction rather than destroyed. A difficult thing. We We can still do the same thing. In fact, I had a person in church one time talk to me after a service. I'd been, you know, preaching through, I think, Mark at the time. And we were talking about, you know, good things, how good God is, how important it is we share the gospel, that kind of stuff, and the message. And after the message, a person in the church came up and talked to me and said, what do you do? How do you respond if you don't want to share the gospel? And so I, you know, gave some pointers because, you know, I said a lot of us get nervous or things like that. So here's some things to keep in mind. And he said, no, I don't want them to hear the gospel. It was like you don't want to talk to them? No, I don't. I don't think they should get saved. And so I don't want them to hear the gospel. What do I do about that? Repent. And that's how we respond. You're wrong. And I didn't say that right to their face that way. I was hopefully kinder, but directing them toward truth can still happen. That's exactly what Jonah's like. I so angry that you didn't just kill them. You could have killed them, and you didn't because you're a kind and loving God. And so he's upset. God responds and says, is it right for you to be upset? And then we have this whole thing with the plant. Plant grows up. There are some particular plants in the area that do grow really fast like this. So this plant grows up and is a shade to Jonah as he's sitting there waiting. He's sitting there waiting for the city to be destroyed. Like that's his, I know God is kind and loving and gracious and is not going to do this because they've responded, but there's still this hope that maybe they'll be destroyed. So I'm going to sit here until the time is up. And this plant comes up and then God sends a worm and destroys the plant. And Jonah's all upset about the plant, which is kind of funny because he wanted to die anyway. So why was he upset about his lack of comfort? But God confronts that. Down at the end, but God said to Jonah, do you do well to be angry for the plant? And he said, yes, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die. He's only got one card he keeps playing over and over. Right. And the Lord said to him, you pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, the great city in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle? The lesson of the plant reveals how callous Jonah was to the lives of other people because of his own national self-righteousness. While not knowing their right hand from their left, maybe an idiom to describe children. So it may mean there are 120,000 children because children struggle with this, right? Until we're like, I don't know, 16, 17. I don't know how old you were when you figured out the left hand makes an L. Some of you were today. Yep. Left hand, L. That's how I learned it. I wasn't 16. I was younger. But, you know, it just means there's 120,000 kids. That's a possible understanding of the phrase. I think, though, it's more likely to be taken as a figurative way of describing spiritual ignorance. Like there's 120,000 people here who do not understand truth. Do not understand the right and the wrong. And so shouldn't I care about these people? I mean, that's God's message to Jonah. And it ends there. Yes.
Do you think that the fact that he brings up the cows, like, is because, like, back when they repented, they, like, covered their beasts with sackcloth and ashes too and had them not eat? Was that kind of emphasizing how they didn't really know what they were repenting from?
Probably, yeah. And then when God is mentioning it, he's looking at, look, it's not just even these people, but all of creation is significant. So he's going to respond to that. And that's where the book ends, which ends in a really hard place as like a reader. We want the whole complete thing. And we don't have it, except that the book itself exists. So sometime Jonah had to write it down. And I think that gives us kind of an indicator of what it is. Okay, let's go on and talk about Nahum. After Micah. Nahum is a short little book, not as short as Obadiah. But still fairly short, and we'll be able to cover it quickly. The author, like many of the minor prophets, little is known about Nahum. Some have suggested that Elkosh, which was his hometown, was near the Sea of Galilee. Capernaum means city of Nahum. And since Nahum wrote after Israel was conquered, though, like given the dating, Israel was no longer a nation. So this seems like an unlikely identification. It is more likely that Elkosh was a city, was a small town in Judah, because Judah was still existing at this time. The setting, Nahum is writing during the dominance of the Assyrian kingdom. Assyria has conquered much of the surrounding nations, including Israel to the north, and had a number of military victories over other nations that it hasn't conquered yet, including Egypt. So Nahum's prophecy seems to be a response to the rise of Assyrian power. In terms of theme, Nahum writes to declare the fall of Nineveh, and through the fall of its capital, the fall of Assyria as well. Thematically, this fall is to bring comfort to Judah, because Assyria has attacked Judah too. They haven't conquered it, but they've also attacked it. So in introduction, Nahum terms this prophecy as both an oracle and a vision. This is both things. He identifies himself very simply. He doesn't give us a lot of flash or anything like that. He just says, the book of Nahum, this is what I have to say. He saves his descriptive language for God and for the destruction to come. So then we get into the judgment. We have the majestic judgment of God. Oh, oracle and vision. Good, we got that. Okay. Nahum describes God as truly awesome and worthy of man's fear. He's jealous, avenging and wrathful. I mean, he's this incredible God. Verses 6 through 11, this gives witness to the truth that God is fearsome to those deserving judgment, but comfort to those who trust in him. Fearsome, this is very much like we dealt with in theology, right? God is in his omnipresence. He's a comfort and a terror. It depends on the individual in their relationship with God. So here, God is fearsome in judgment, but comfort to those who trust him. Verses 12 through 14, the attention turns to the earthly situation between Judah and Nineveh. Here, following God's character, Nineveh will be destroyed and the Israelites upheld. So this is after Jonah, still dealing with the same place, but God responds to them differently at different times because there's different things going on in the life of Nineveh in Assyria. So we turn to the monumental judgment on Nineveh. The good news, 1:15. Behold, upon the mountain, the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace. Keep your feasts, O Judah. Fulfill your vows, for never again shall the worthless pass before you. He is utterly cut off. So the good news that is coming is not that you are going to be saved. The good news is that the enemy is conquered, and the Israelites can now live in peace. That's the good news in this context. In chapter 2, verses 6 and 8, Nineveh was built so that the tributaries of the Tigris flowed through it, which helped always, they always had water, and it was good for sanitation. You can kind of push stuff into the river and it washes down. So they let the river kind of travel through the city. During the siege that the Babylonians and the Medes have, there was flooding. And perhaps some of that flooding was even accomplished by the invaders. And that's sort of the prediction, that they used the river and the gates of the river to help conquer Nineveh. They forced a flood to wash out a portion of the city, which is what God is predicting. So it happened as predicted. Chapter 3, this woe to the bloody city, the prostitute betraying the nations, serves as the center of a larger chiasmus, which takes place in the book, and it is there in your notes, correct? So you can kind of see the book actually has a highly functional style here. Nahum is not just writing willy-nilly, hey, this is what will sound good now. He's writing with intention, and it comes down to this woe oracle at the beginning of chapter 3, and then it's going to come back and work out. The book ends because of their cruelty, part of the reason that they're being judged. No one will grieve when Nineveh is overthrown. And that is our closing statement. There is no easing your hurt. Your wound is grievous. All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you, for upon whom has not come your unceasing evil. So when Nineveh is destroyed, everyone's happy. Finally, someone has done something. And that is Nahum. So in Jonah, we get hope and redemption for Nineveh. In Nahum, we see the culmination of the judgment because of the way they've responded to everyone else. All right, that will conclude Minor Prophets for this period. I will see you again in Minor Prophets' fourth period, but we will have theology before that. But my goodness, go take some time, walk around. Hopefully there's snacks in the dining hall. Stretch, eat, use the restroom, hydrate, do all the good things. I will see you in a while for theology.